Well, here we are in volume 6 of this series entitled Jesus Christ's Super Nut or Supernatural by Dr. Gene Scott. This was a series of pamphlets that Dr. Scott produced back in the early 70s. Each one carries an introduction. I'm going to start today by reading the introduction to this volume 6. And so we begin. College students, wrote one of my professors at Stanford University, seek for a creed, for a formula for their lives. They stand on the threshold of manhood with raised thumbs, like hitchhikers, awaiting a driver who will carry them along the road to a more abundant, more fruitful life. I was such a student, like the hitchhiker in the metaphor drivers, at universities carried me along roads which almost destroyed a faith in Jesus Christ as God. This series of volumes traces those early rides and outlines the steps taken, which led again to a faith in Jesus as the supernatural revelation of God. Many of the essays were written previously, but have been redone and incorporated into the present volumes. While preparing these books, I journeyed again to lands dominated by alternative religious views. This was to refresh my studies about comparative religions done years earlier in university days. The trip went first to the Far East, where Volume 1 was written. Volume 2 was finished in Istanbul after a long journey from Hong Kong through Europe and Israel. Volume 3 took shape in Copenhagen during the summer of youth invasion of 1972. Volume 4 focused on an unusual Saturday night in Bristol, England, and the incongruity represented by carousing youth swinging in and out of bars under the shadow of church spires on All Saints Street near All Saints Court by the famous All Saints Church. Volume 5 swung south to Peru, home of the ancient Inca, Mochica, and Chimú cultures, to witness the 151st year freedom celebration. In the shadow of the oldest university in the Western Hemisphere, the author talked with kids searching for meaning, but endangered by limited fact conclusions. Now this volume 6 tunes in on the crux of the issue about Christ. It faces square the four basic reasons for believing the testimonies about the astonishing events called the resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ. The quote-unquote message of the modern rock opera, Jesus Christ Superstar, is examined in chapter 1, and again in the final pages of this volume. It is compared then contrasted with the quote-unquote message of the New Testament reporters. I followed the production of Jesus Christ Superstar, both film and stage, from Israeli Negev to San Francisco to Sydney, Australia. As chapter 1 would say, the cast of Superstar told their story, then got on a bus and rode back to the good life. The New Testament disciples told their story, then paid with their lives. That's the difference. This volume asks, which story, which tellers of the story are you really going to believe? That's why we have entitled this volume, Who's Putting Who On? If the result to a reader is increased attention to the real Christ of history, then this work is successful. And we move on and begin to read the literature I read, the historical record, and the New Testament showed this kind of person called Jesus. He presumed all authority to himself with no objective criteria apart from himself. He evidenced no sense of moral inadequacy, no felt sin, no sense of failure or shortcoming, no need for forgiveness on any account. He presented himself as having eternal existence, having a first-hand acquaintance with the eternal things, and he projected a continued post-earthly life after his temporary task was finished on this world scene. He placed himself at the center of the religious universe and made allegiance to his personal self the doorway to eternal life. He diagnosed a wrongness to this world and its creatures that could only be made right by his death. He prophesied that after his death, he would rise again. Neely, who was the star in the movie, Jesus Christ Superstar, says of Jesus, he was one hell of a man among men. I agree that he was a something else kind of a man. But hell is hardly the word for it. The rock opera Superstar presents Jesus as just a man who began to believe his own advertisement articulated by the crowds and died a tragic, pitiable martyr. A Jesus so unreal to the facts of history that the ethereal glow of sunrise on this harsh desert landscape in front of me seemed the perfect symbol of its distorted view. Dr. Scott continues and gives an overview of the film. He says, Dateline Regency Theater, San Francisco, California. I was back home in San Francisco when I finally saw the movie Jesus Christ Superstar. It was playing at the Regency 2 Theater on Van Ness. Taking part of my staff, we parked in an alley off Polk Street, a block away. He says, natives in the know call it Polkstrasse, with more of San Francisco's gay community congregated here than in any other single area in the city. He says, I couldn't help but see the irony in the situation. Here we are, everybody's favorite city, dodging homos on Polkstrasse, en route to see Jesus Christ Superstar. Wow! That must say something about today's mixed-up world. The blazing Negev Desert of Israel came back to full memory as the film opened with smashing music and brilliant photography. Mary Magdalene made her points about happiness, sleep, and love. Simon the Zealot danced and screamed up a storm. Peter looked confused about the whole thing. Judas was the hero. Jesus, the tragic waste. The Jewish priests caused his death. Herod danced and sang the Jesus rag, and the Romans did the job of killing Jesus. When it was finished, I walked out into the misty San Francisco night air saying, "Now, what did all this say?" Answer, the song said the whole thing. Jesus Christ, Superstar, who are you? What did you sacrifice? That's all. No answers, just questions. Jesus Christ, Superstar, who are you? What did you sacrifice? Now I said, ain't that a world-shaking contribution to mankind's knowledge? I was reminded of an old Southerner's description of a sermon delivered by an overly pompous preacher. Lo, a mountain has conceived and brought forth a mouse. As we said in volume one of this series, in today's world, Jesus may be seen as a mouthpiece for far-out views about life without being seen in his far more far-out views about his own life. Or Jesus may be worshipped or described, who didn't exist, one of man's own creation, and the real Christ be missed because of the artificial rhetorical dust we create. Jesus Christ, Superstar, must be the crowning example for this, plus adding brilliant musical sounds to its rhetorical dust. And it leaves Jesus dead, a tragic martyr, on a fool's course, with only a haunting question to summarize his life. Who are you? What did you sacrifice? And his disciples, poor buffoons as they were portrayed, except Judas. At a Last Supper where Jesus Superstar asks, what if it were my blood? What if it were my body? They sing a song about writing the Gospels after they retire so they'll be remembered when they're gone. The cast of Superstar told their message, then got on a bus and rode out of the desert back to the good life. The New Testament disciples told their message and paid with their lives. That's quite a difference. So come on now. Which story, which tellers of the story, are you really going to believe? This next chapter is entitled, For This Price, They Can't Be Putting Me On. A brief reminder, the first four volumes in this series of studies describe the uniqueness of Christianity's beginning, the uniqueness of Christ's claims about himself and the importance of the resurrection to any clear view of Christ. Volume 5 concentrated on the many theories of the resurrection and explained that the whole issue ultimately revolves around the truthfulness of the disciples. We needn't cover that ground again in detail, but briefly stated, our premise in volumes 1 through 5 states two things. The only Jesus, called the Christ, to be found in history, went about saying and doing things which make him either super nut, super fake, or supernatural. This same Jesus, the Christ, who said and did such strange things, is also claimed to have risen from the dead and ascended into heaven. That resurrection story, if true, gives substance to the belief that he was truly supernatural, not super fake, and not super nut. We went further in Volume 5, saying that a careful analysis of facts surrounding Jesus' death and resurrection allows only two possible explanations for the resurrection message. The disciples lied about the whole story, or they were honest men reporting what they honestly saw and experienced. Volume 5 focused also on the reasons why this choice of alternatives about the disciples' truthfulness is forced by the facts. Now, in this volume, we turn to a basis for the belief that these men were telling the truth. And their story offers much more substantive help than the plaintive questions of superstar. A cataclysmic change. If history recorded no testimony to Jesus' resurrection, a careful student of Jesus' disciples would still wonder what happened to change them so simultaneously. And after the death of Jesus, with its accompanying and sorry spectacle of the disciples failing Jesus, those same disciples were suddenly and dramatically changed, cataclysmically so, and for the better. Now, I believe that deliberate lying can change a man, but seldom for the better. And I repeat, these disciples were changed, all of them, for the better, as they emerged after the crucifixion to witness about the resurrection. For a moment, try to imagine that we are present when Jesus chose his original disciples. Look them over. Look them over closely. Here comes Peter. He smells like fish. And every time he opens his mouth, you can tell he hasn't gone to school very much. He is unstable in his nature. He swears one moment that he will die for his Lord, but then denies him 3 times. James and John are next in view. They are high-tempered. Sons of thunder, oppose them and they will try to call down fire from heaven on you. They want the best seats in Jesus' kingdom, and they allow their mother to ask for it. They were not even straightforward enough to fight for the best seat themselves. Thomas is a doubter. Matthew is a cheating tax collector. Simon is a zealot. He wants to fight the Romans. That's all he lives for. You look closely at this band of disciples, and they just don't impress one as a group of men capable of deceiving the world with a fantastic lie and remaining true to that lie until their dying day. As a group, they miserably failed Jesus in the last week of his ministry. But if I had no resurrection story to read about and could see this same group of men front and behind the recorded resurrection event, I would have to be amazed at their change. A closer look at the men as individuals is even more convincing. Peter is unstable in all his ways, as already pointed out. He's not willing just to be beaten for his master. He says, "I'll die for you." He's an extremist. "They can slay me, but I'll not deny you," he said. Shortly thereafter, he denies him three times. Peter is weak. At the judgment of Jesus, he can't look a little girl in the face and say, "I'm one of his disciples." When he goes through the doorway at the house of Annas, she says, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" "I am not," he replies. At the fire with the soldiers, they say, "You're one of his disciples. Your speech gives you away." So he began to curse and swear to identify with that crowd and said, "I'm not one of his disciples." Unstable, weak, unpredictable. That's Peter. Jesus said, "I'm going to wash your feet." "Not mine," he says. "You're not going to wash mine." His mouth is always in gear before his head is in motion. "Well, if I can't wash your feet," Jesus indicates, "you are not going to get in to the kingdom." "Wash me all over," Peter cries. "All or nothing," that's Peter. Peter is sleeping on the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus took them up there in a moment of crisis to share the future about his crucifixion. They climb that hill and Peter goes to sleep. He wakes up to hear voices identified by the gospel record as Jesus talking to Elijah and Moses on the mount. Coming out of a sleep, bleary-eyed, he jumps up and cried, "Let us build three tabernacles." He put Moses and Elijah on an equal basis with Jesus. The gospels say that God had to rebuke him. Moses and Elijah disappeared, and God spoke out of heaven, saying, "This is my son. Hear ye him." "I'm going to Calvary," Jesus said. And Peter, still speaking out of turn, says, "Be it far from thee." He had to be rebuked strongly. Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan, you speak as a man." If you study the personality of this man, he is the most unpredictable and consistently unstable of all the disciples. But something changed Peter. Follow Peter after the book of Acts. And after the resurrection event, he's a changed man. On the day of Pentecost, a mocking mob gathered at the bottom of the building on the street. Peter stood and faced those who were mocking. The one that couldn't talk to a young girl earlier speaks now to a mocking mob. And he accuses them, saying, "Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as ye yourselves also know. Him ye have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain, whom God has raised up, having loosed the pains of death, whereof we are all witnesses." And the result of his preaching was to bring 3,000 into the church in one day. He began to exhibit the meaning of his name that day, the Rock. In the next chapter, they told him to shut up preaching, and he says, "Ye denied the Holy One and the just, and desired a murderer to be granted unto you, and killed the Prince of Life, whom God has raised from the dead, whereof we are all witnesses." They brought him before the priest, who said, "Don't you preach this way anymore." Peter says, "Shall we obey God or man?" He continued to preach like that, with never a waver, to his death. When they want to crucify him, tradition has him saying, "Turn me upside down. I'm not worthy to be crucified in the position of my Lord." To scattered saints all across Mid-Asia, Peter writes his epistles, 1st and 2nd Peter, and talks about a suffering beyond that which most of us will ever experience. But every item in his epistles is emphasizing, you are citizens of a heavenly land. You are children of a heavenly Father. You are pilgrims on a journey to an ultimate destination. Act like citizens in an alien land. Let no persecution or problem cower you, but let the world see by your living testimony that you are a citizen of a heavenly country, and nothing can change you, nothing can cower you, nothing can break you down. That's a changed man talking. As expressed earlier, I believe a lie can change a man, but not for the better. And to change from instability to stability is a change for the better. Look now at John. As also indicated earlier, John was selfish. I've never understood why many Bible readers believe that John was such a sweet, wonderful, loving person. He was close to Christ. He was in the inner circle, but he wasn't all so sweet and loving. James and John got the nickname Sons of Thunder. They were selfish. They were constantly bickering and causing trouble because they wanted the best seat in Jesus' kingdom. If anyone was contrary to love and humility, John was. And as we've already indicated, allowing his mother to ask for the best seat in the kingdom reveals a disappointing quality of character for a man. Yet, who of all the disciples became the epitome of love? John. You don't find progression in it, just a sharp stop. First, you see a selfish, high-tempered, troublemaking, wanting the best seat, John. Then, all of a sudden, on the other side of the resurrection, John becomes love incarnate, gentleness embodied, patience on display, the epitome of love. His gospel and his epistles, above all the writings in the New Testament, become expressions of love. That's a change. It's a change for the better, from self-centered, high-tempered, self-seeking nature to total, unselfish love. Could this be caused by telling a lie? Look at Thomas. Someone said, if I didn't believe in Christ, I would believe the genius that wove this mosaic together. All this is not just in one book. When you study the personality of Thomas and of all these disciples, you find their character picture woven through different books, different chapters, and written in diverse places of the Middle Eastern lands. Thomas was always a doubter. On one occasion, Jesus faced a dangerous journey. One of his disciples said, "Let's go with him on the trip that we may die with him also." That's John 11:16. Now, it is admirable for Thomas to be courageous like that. He saw a dangerous journey. He expected Jesus to be killed. And stepping in front of the other disciples, he says, "Let's go with him to die also." You have to admire his love, and you have to admire his courage. But that's hard-headed humanism. He expected Jesus to be killed on that journey. He was a realist. To Thomas, things were just exactly as they looked. He wasn't a mystic. The way was dangerous. People were killed on such trips. Jesus was going, so Thomas says, "Let's go die with him." To him, Jesus could be killed by human hands. That's not very spiritual. Jesus always said that he would voluntarily lay his life down. Even to Pilate, Jesus said that it really was not in Pilate's hands to kill him. To Peter, Jesus pointed out that he could call legions to help him. Angels to fight on his behalf. But to the view of Thomas, Jesus could be killed on a dangerous journey like any ordinary man. Let's take another illustration. In John 14, Jesus tells them that he is going to leave them. You don't have to be super spiritual to understand that. "I'm going to leave you. I'm going to a place and prepare mansions for you," Jesus said. I can see most of the disciples never getting past that statement. They'd tune in on the mansions and start rejoicing and not hear another thing Jesus says. But Thomas is a realist. He listens. "I'm going to a place. I'm going to prepare mansions in that place. I'm going to come back and get you. And I'm going to take you to be with me." I can understand every bit of that, Thomas must say to himself. And he's still listening. And in the next line, Jesus says, "And whither I go, you know, and the way, you know." Thomas interrupts. "We don't know where you're going, and how can we know the way? Read it." That's the voice of a skeptical realist. Everywhere you meet him, Thomas is a doubter. So who is doubting at the crucifixion? When the resurrection report comes, who disbelieves? Hard-headed Thomas. Unless I can thrust my hand into his side and touch the literal print of the nails, I won't believe he is risen. That's Thomas, just being his consistent, questioning self. The day came when Jesus appeared and said, "Behold my hands and my side." And Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." The record says he was convinced by seeing, and he was changed thereafter. To me, it is significant that Thomas took his faith into the most difficult areas to penetrate with the Christian message. It is Thomas who pierced the Himalayas. It is Thomas who went into India. It is Thomas who penetrated the seat of profound philosophical religions. From out of India, Vedanta faith comes, the Buddhist religions, both the northern and southern tiers of it. Into that seat. Excuse me, I'm having trouble with the book. Into that seat of Eastern philosophic religions, that seat of deep and thought-provoking studies of ultimate reality, that's where Thomas went. And you never find him wavering in his faith again. Thomas was pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. He had done his work as the missionary to India. He was never found doubting after the resurrection. That's a change from doubt to faith. Look also at James, the brother of Jesus. He was a natural relative. And you know who will get on to you the most when you get super spiritual? Your relatives. They're the ones that don't want you embarrassing them with your crazy claims. Do you know who gave Jesus his trouble? His relatives. When he began to preach about his divine commission, they sought to lay hands on him. At Nazareth, they thought he was beside himself. It was his relatives who wondered about this man, who grew up in their midst, suddenly preaching strange things about himself. To me, it is very significant that his natural brother became the rock bed of faith in the city of Jerusalem itself. A change. Cataclysmically, these men changed from those positions of instability, selfishness, doubt, and rejection attitude to stability, unselfish love, unwavering faith, and the very rock foundation of the homeland church was one that knew him as a natural brother, his brother James. Now this sudden and dramatic cataclysmic change is the first reason why I just cannot believe that these men were lying. With that kind of change in their personalities, it is hard to give credit to a deliberate lie as the causal or concomitant force. Let's look at some internal evidences. There are In addition, many very convincing internal evidence for truth in the New Testament reports themselves. Let's take some random samples. Most all New Testament scholars agree that Mark wrote his gospel for Gentile readers. There is some debate as to whether the focus was to Egypt or to Roman readers, but in any event, the anticipated readers were to be Gentiles. In other words, non-Jew. It is also well known that Mark was intending to show his readers that Jesus was the Son of God. Yet, Mark has Jesus referencing himself as Son of Man more than any other gospel writer. This does not appear significant until analyzed closely. To Hebrew readers familiar with the Old Testament, particularly the book of Daniel and the apocryphal book of Enoch, the phrase Son of Man brought up mental pictures of one coming on clouds of glory in supernatural power to establish his kingdom as Messiah. In point of fact, Son of Man was full of supernatural and divine connotations to Hebrew readers, but to Gentile readers, Egyptian or Roman, the phrase Son of Man had no such associations. To the uninitiated reader in Egypt or Rome, Mark's target, Son of Man suggested humanity, not divinity. Now, if Mark was part of the plot to deceive, if he was deliberately propagating a lie, why not tell a good one? Isn't it reasonable to assume that if he were smart enough to propagate the lie, and if truth were not important, that Mark, trying to show Jesus as the Son of God, would have Jesus call himself by a term other than Son of Man? Yet Mark has Jesus reference himself as Son of Man more than any other writer. That makes Mark look to me like an honest reporter of what Jesus said. Example, using a phrase quite appropriate in a Jewish frame where they were uttered, in spite of the fact that Jesus' use of the phrase Son of Man might hurt Mark's objective, which was to prove that Jesus was the Son of God to Gentile readers. In short, Mark sounds more honest than devious on this point. While on Mark, another item seems significant. Peter was the source of much of Mark's material, and it is Mark who most graphically portrays Peter's failures and weaknesses. If Mark had no regard for the truth, he could have painted a better picture of Peter. Yet, in spite of his closeness to him and his debt to Peter for help and tutelage, for history records, Paul had written Mark off earlier, but Barnabas and then Peter helped him. Mark tells it the way it was about Peter. Again, he comes through as an honest reporter. Still another item, giving some internal indication of honesty, relates to the 7-week delay in broadcasting the resurrection testimony. Some critics point to this as a weakness in the record. They hint that the seven-week delay was needed by the disciples to regroup, fabricate, and gel their tale. The New Testament presents a simple sequence of events. The disciples were crushed by the crucifixion. The disciples were surprised by the resurrection. The disciples were told by a resurrected Christ to wait at Jerusalem for an experience promised and identified as the Holy Spirit before witnessing to the world. The disciples did just what they were told. They waited at Jerusalem in an upper room. They received a strange and different experience, which they identified as the promised happening. They immediately, that day and no sooner or later, though it was 7 weeks after the crucifixion, began to tell the world their story. I get the picture again of simple, honest, non-devious men who never gave a thought as to whether the seven-week delay would help or hurt their story. They just experienced things as they happened and simply told the story as it was. Still picking random samples, there are abundant little and minute details in the records that evidence honest reporting. Many of these are so incidental at first glance that they would be missed unless searched for. Take this one. When Jesus faced the multitude needing food, before the gospel record of strange and miraculous feeding of the multitude, John 6:5 records that Jesus asked Philip where to buy bread. Why ask Philip? Only by going to other gospel records will the full picture take shape. Luke, in his gospel, notes the fact that the incident with the multitude occurred at a place near Bethsaida. That's Luke 9:10. In yet another place, John notes the fact that Philip came from Bethsaida. That's John 1:44. Now, with all the facts, Jesus' question to Philip makes sense. Philip had lived at Bethsaida. The hungry multitude was near Bethsaida, and Jesus asked Philip where to buy bread. Philip was the proper one to ask. They were near his home. Yet, remember, the full set of facts is supplied by different gospel writers, writing separately, in separate places, at separate times, to separate people. Only the whole record verified the logic of an apparent incidental question to Philip by Jesus. It's not an earth-shaking revelation, but it is one more piece among many in a mosaic that shows accuracy in reporting. The writers sound honest. They don't read like liars. But I can't help but feel that if they set out to deliberately fabricate a lie, they would be found less careful in other areas, less attentive to detail and accuracy. Yet the records have withstood the onslaught of critics for centuries and still come off strong in conveying sincere and honest reporting by the writers. If so, on other items, Why not the resurrection reporting also? It is circular reasoning, which says a miracle cannot occur, therefore anyone who reports a miracle is a faulty reporter. Other evidence indicates careful truth in reporting facts, and the fact that miracle is reported as a fact should not be rejected on its face. At issue in this chapter is the question, are the reporters deliberate liars or honest reporters? The internal evidence added to the cataclysmic changes in their personalities make them look honest to me. But that's not all. As a third indication of their truthfulness, you don't suffer what they suffered for a lie. Here's a brief list of the traditional record of their deaths. Bartholomew was flayed with a whip. That's skinned alive with a whip and died. St. Andrew was crucified on St. Andrew's cross, the crisscross, from which it gets its name. Peter, as we've said, was crucified upside down in Rome. Thomas was pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. Philip preached in Phrygia, died a martyr at Hierapolis. James the Less was crucified in Egypt. Simon the Zealot was crucified also. Jude preached in Assyria and Persia, in which latter country he was martyred. James of Zebedee preached in Judea and was beheaded by Herod Antipas about 44 AD. Only one of these disciples missed a martyr's death. That was John, who was banished to the Isle of Patmos. He suffered great persecution, though not unto death. You don't suffer that way for a lie, but, and the most convincing proof, as St. Thomas Aquinas has pointed out, and even more important, which is the fourth broad reason I can't believe they were lying, they suffered alone. Now, imagine with me for a moment, that a group of us decide we're going to make up this lie. Our Lord's been crucified. We all believed in him. Now we have to save face. So we're going to agree to tell the lie that he rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. I might believe that if you kept us all together, even if you threw us together into an arena to die, as long as we were together, group pressure might hold us to our story. But no one would want to be the one that said, it's not true. No one would want to be the one to break rank. That group pressure, I repeat, would hold us together. The significance of these disciples' story is that they suffered and died alone, and ironically, they couldn't stand before the resurrection as a group. As a group, they fled and left Jesus to be crucified alone. But after the resurrection, though scattered far and wide, they suffered alone without one deviation from their story. Let's push this concept far out. For a moment, imagine that you are Bartholomew. You are down in Armenia. It has taken you months to get there under transportation methods of that day. There is no telegram, no satellite, no TV, no mail service. I might say no internet, as we now have it. To carry this further, let another friend be Peter in Rome, as Thomas, I'm in India, How do you know where I am? How do you know where Peter is? How do I know where you are? You are down in Armenia. You've testified to the resurrection story that we've agreed to tell. They tie you to a post and begin to skin you alive with a whip. And all you have to do to save yourself is to recant the stories and say, it's all a fake. How would I know? How would the other friend, Peter, know? The next boat out. You can shake my hand, like Thomas, when you see me, and smile at Peter when you get to Rome. I won't know whether you broke the story or not. It is just beyond psychological conception to me that one of these men would, that these men would die alone without one of them breaking under the pressure. Yet I challenge you to find a shred in history where one of the men, proven weaklings, proven selfish, proven unstable, prior to the resurrection, ever weakened their story after the resurrection. They told the same thing, though dying horrible deaths alone in far-flung sections of the then-known world with not a single shred of evidence that one of them ever altered in the story. It's inconceivable that they wouldn't weaken under such pressure. Why didn't they weaken? That's easy to explain if their story was really true. Postscript. Now, so what if it is true? Answer. Then, Jesus, the Christ, is more than natural, and that's supernatural. And we are not left with just a question. We have an answer. The next time I saw Jesus Christ Superstar was at the Capitol Theater in Sydney, Australia. The cast was different. They had Christian exposure for Ted Knopf at the famous Wayside Chapel in King's Cross had told me a few days earlier that many of the actors were associated with Wayside. The stage setting was not so magnificent as the film, but yet impressive in its own way, and the music was still superb. The basic impact remained the same. Questions. No answers. Jesus Christ, Superstar, who are you? What did you sacrifice? It ends with death and leaves a question. It was a good act, but it gave no hope. The New Testament record ends with life, resurrected life. And because of that life provides an answer. It gives an answer to deep and fundamental questions. And they all relate to Jesus' claims about himself. The believer can now say there is a source of authority, a benchmark to which one can relate in a twisted, changing world, Jesus and what he had to say. There is an ultimate ideal for human behavior to which one can relate. A flesh and blood measure of perfection. Jesus, who expressed himself in love of a nature to challenge both my selfish living and that of a non-caring world. There is an answer to the ever-present questions of life after death, of immortality, and its sober implications, and the answer is from one, Jesus, who has seen the other side and has straightforwardly reported about its ways. There is an answer to man's perennial sense of moral inadequacies and his need to be loved and forgiven from one Jesus who performs perfectly himself and yet stands in the place of the imperfect to pay for and free them from their penalty. There is a basis for believing that God himself, ultimate reality, is personal and loving, and that knowledge of God himself can be had by a knowledge of Jesus, the Christ, a real person on the stage of history who walked ordinary streets in ordinary towns to relate to ordinary people and ordinary things. And the resurrection gives rationale for a continuing relation with an unseen God presence and a hope of one's own resurrection and eternal life after this life. Now, that's all pretty mind-boggling, but it all makes sense if the resurrection is true. And it is. And more than all that, if the resurrection is true, it gives credence to yet another claim of Jesus. He said, "I will come again."
Yes, I'll rise. And that's the God School. That's Dr. Gene Scott's presentation on the resurrection and life of Jesus Christ.